fellowship, and let's continue on here. We are dealing with this situation in which Jesus has taken the disciples across the Sea of Galilee to the northeast side has spent the day teaching. Ostensibly, of course, the trip was to provide the disciples some downtime because they were exhausted. And Jesus was attempting to get them some R&R, but that didn't work out because of his compassionate response to the great numbers of people that showed up there who were, as he points out, like a sheep without a shepherd. And so now the disciples, it's late in the day, they're tired, they're frustrated, they're hungry, and they're cranky, and they don't want to take responsibility for this crowd. It's not their fault. As they would see it, that these people were here. They came out of their own free will, and kind of the idea they tell Jesus is, well, just let them fend for themselves. They'll be fine. And so Jesus doesn't really acknowledge what they said at all. And he said, you give them something to eat. And that's where we are in verse 37. He answered, you give them something to eat. And they said to him, shall we go and spend 200 denarii on bread and give them something to eat? And again, assuming that a denarius would buy 2 days' worth of meals, you're still only talking 1,200 meals in a crowd of probably, it's in excess of 10,000, no doubt, maybe closer to 20. So, and that's over 6 months' pay. It's, in fact, almost 7 months' pay. So this was unrealistic, and they knew it was unrealistic. And he keeps challenging them here, and essentially what he's doing is challenging them to do the impossible. And so they're sitting there very much thinking, we can't do the impossible. And we're not capable, and we're not even going to think about it. We just want to get rid of these people and go our way. So we got down here that we stopped, I think, with the idea here in point 11 that these disciples had just come back from a tour of duty. And now some time may have elapsed. I mean, this could be 2 or 3 months later. But still, they've seen a lot of miracles. They themselves have done miracles. They had healed people, anointed people with oil and healed them. They had cured the sick. They had cast out demons. And so they'd seen miracles accomplished by their hands, but they very quickly forget about this. Again, this is one of the things when you face tests in the Christian life. Part of your history should allow you to reflect back and say, you know what? God has delivered me in the past. Whatever test I'm facing now, God is capable. And your history, as you grow with doctrine and as you grow in grace and in faith, should have more confidence in God as you go. Well, they're hardened of heart, unfortunately. They really are manifesting some unbelief here. And the biggest thing they manifest unbelief towards is that Jesus is God. They still don't buy this yet. And so they are just looking at this. And again, as we pointed out earlier in the first session, that they were comfortable enough with Jesus to, in some cases, try to order him around and to express their frustration with him on certain occasions, as we have seen, when he didn't do like they thought he should. And so Jesus here, they've got plenty of experience. They should have some confidence in this, that Jesus is not ordering them to do something they can't do. That's another principle. God does not, in his word, provide imperatives that he does not provide the wherewithal to carry those imperatives out. So if something is commanded in the scripture, guess what? It can be done. So when people say, well, I can't do that. Well, you're lying to yourself, because if the Bible commands you to do it, you can do it. Now, you may not want to do it, but then be honest and just say, I don't want to do it. But don't try to lay it off to a lack of resources on God's part. Because God has plenty of resources. God owns everything. God doesn't lack anything. And all of it's at his disposal at all times. And he bestows his blessings, his grace, and all of this on the positive believer. The people that line up with his word get to live much higher on the in terms of history than most people do. And I'm not talking about just financially. God may bless you financially. But given the world that we live in, given the fact that men's hearts are failing them because of fear, everybody High price of gas, high price of food, inflation, the Greek crisis. What are we going to do about their debt? Now Spain, now Portugal. Oh, my goodness. Well, guess what? The world is in a mess. Then you got the tsunamis, or, you know, wandering around from time to time. The forest fires, the national tragedies. God help us if we get hit with a hurricane this year. It'll be the end of the world as we know it. But I'll feel fine, to coin a phrase. And the idea is that, look, as you go in all of this, God's in control. But the world doesn't see that. And certainly, it's nice just knowing that, well, okay, God's plan's advancing the way he wants it to. There's still nut jobs setting dates for the rapture. Oh, good, thank God they're with us. Another black eye for Jesus. That's good. He just doesn't get beat up enough. And of course, the news, you know, the liberal media has, you know, the darn liberal media has made light of this. Like, these people are nut jobs. Oh, they are. And by the way, like I pointed out first session, they're so far off on stuff, it's not even funny. They didn't get the birth of Christ right. They're like, oh, 4 years off on that one. About 7,000 years off on the beginning of man. Way off on the Great Tribulation, as they called it. And guess what? They missed the rapture, too. What a shock. Well, but just knowing doctrine and knowing where things are, where they're headed, that's to me a great comfort. And so those that apply the word, those that take it seriously, well, guess what? They end up with the blessings. And the disciples, unfortunately, are not doing this. So 12, the first observation that can be made is that the disciples very quickly forgot all the things that they had done and focused on the difficulty of the moment. This is hard. This is impossible. Well, wait a minute. What does the Bible say? Doesn't it say there's nothing impossible with God? Hey, did you ever hear the story about this 100-year-old guy and his 90-year-old wife? They had a baby. Did you ever hear about the ark? Did you ever hear, you know, and it was funny because I was watching a show yesterday. I can't remember if it was on Discovery or Nat Geo. It was on one of those channels. And they were showing, you know, they were engaged in this deal on Egyptian boat building to see, you know, how they could do it and if they could make boats, you know, and like the Egyptians would have made and use them. And so they did all this, and I was kind of thinking about the ark, but essentially, they tried to make a boat without any caulk on the seams. It was all wood. And they thought, okay, here's the first thing we'll do is we'll go out and we'll sink the boat. Then you think, well, why would they do that? Well, they're trying to get the wood to swell and to seal up all the cracks and holes in it. And of course, the boat immediately sank. And so they let it sit there for a few days and let it absorb water, and they brought it out and they dried it all off and all that. And guess what? The wood swelled, but it still leaked. And so they finally figured out, okay, well, you've got to. So what they did it with was some linen. They took the cracks and they filled them in with linen and some beeswax, which were things that would have existed at that time in Egypt's history. And I thought to myself, well, think of the, you know, they built a little boat that held, maybe, I don't know, 20 people or something. It was about the size of that Jesus boat, if you ever looked at that on the internet, that was designed to hold about that many people. And they did all this and all the problems they had with it. I mean, the boat, because it had a rounded hull when they got in it, I mean, when they were not underway, and they put it in at the Red Sea, on that the western arm of the Red Sea down there. And when they did this, this boat was sitting like this in the water. And I mean, literally going from side to side. And one time it took water in over the rail when they went down. And they thought, okay, if we keep rocking like this, we're going to be dead. Well, once they got underway, the boat stopped rocking as much. But then when I looked at that little boat and all the things they went through to pull this off, and this was with, they tried not to use, they weren't using modern technology, they were just using primitive shipbuilding things. The miracle of Noah is just astonishing. That he built a boat on the scale of a modern ocean liner, and that it held all these animals and all these people, well, only eight people, well, not a whole lot of people, but all these animals. And the flood lasted basically from the time it started raining almost a year until they came out of the ark. So what kind of phenomenal deal was this? I mean, obviously God was in it. And then you see about the miracles that are done in Egypt there before the Exodus, the miracles that are done after the Exodus as they attack Jericho by marching around it holding pitchers. Not pictures, you look at it, I mean a little pitcher. So this is how they fight. Well, that seems odd. Yeah, because God's doing miracles. He knocks those walls down all by himself. He didn't need Israel to do it. So again, when people get into difficult situations, they immediately seem to forget about, well, wait a minute, God's helped me in the past. Why would I think he's abandoned me now? And this is a sign of direct unbelief. This is just exactly what the Exodus generation did when they got out there and said, you've brought us out here to kill us. And they forgot all about God's deliverance, all about the miracles in Egypt, all about the parting of the Red Sea. Hey, did I mention that one? I mean, that had to be pretty impressive to see. They forget all about this and they focus on the difficulty of the moment and, oh my God, it can't be done. Well, guess what? That's just unbelief. That's all it is. So 13, when one encounters difficulty in the Christian way of life, this is the time to remember the previous blessings and provision of God and not be overwhelmed by momentary light affliction. James 1, 2 through 8 there. And again, James 1, 2, the translation is not good. It's should be, consider every joy, not consider it all joy. It's to consider every joy, and it's a command to focus on the joys of the Christian way of life, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. Knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And so one of the things we should know is that testing is designed to produce patience in us. Endurance has the idea of patience in regard to circumstances. As opposed to patience in regard with people. The ability to bear up under the things of life that you have to confront. And let endurance have its perfect result so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. But if any of you lacks wisdom, well, that's all of us, frankly. This is designed understatement here. James knows everybody lacks wisdom. Let him ask of God. The question is, do you know you lack wisdom? And are you asking God for it regularly? Because you should be. Let him ask of God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But he must ask in faith, without any doubting. For the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For that man ought not to expect he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. So you have the two choices in life when you confront various testings and trials and all of this. You can either trust God in it, or you can be double-minded about it and live in unbelief and don't expect God to help you. Well, I presume that God is for us, that he delights in helping his people, but he also delights in them, you know, recognizing that as well. Well, 14, the failure to reflect on the previous provision of God was characteristic of the unbelief of the Jews of the Exodus generation. They would witness a miraculous deliverance or provision and immediately respond with unbelief at the onset of the next test. Exodus 16, 2 and 3 is an example of that. So here I am. I've seen these 10 miracles done in Egypt. I've seen the Red Sea parted. I've seen my enemies destroyed behind me. I've been told by God, you're going to a land that's flowing with milk and honey, which is a figure of speech for great prosperity, that this is a prosperous land, a blessed land, that has all the provision you need. And I've seen all this, and then immediately I get tested. The whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The sons of Israel said to them, would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt. Why is it when every time people get into unbelief and stuff, they just think they're going to die? Listen, God, you just kill me. Well, that's what they prayed for here, or they asked about anyway. When we sat by the pots of meat and we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. And they've seen all this, and the first time they're tested, what do? They turn around and attack their spiritual leader. Because it's clearly his fault. I mean, and poor Aaron, what has he done? Aaron didn't do anything. But he gets it because he's there. Exodus 17. And so after this, the Exodus 16, God provides the manna. So they get 6 days, they're going to get free food, 6 days a week. Well, guess what? So that goes on. They've seen this. 17:2, therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, why now have you brought us from Egypt to kill us, our children, and our livestock with thirst? You tried killing us with hunger, and that didn't work. Now you're going to kill us with thirst. And so Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do with this people? A little more, and they will kill me. And God said, well, everybody must get stoned. So Moses knows that these people are nuts. I mean, and when you're in unbelief, you are nuts. When you aren't trusting God, you are nuts. I mean, I am nuts. Because God has definitely proven himself in the angelic conflict. And the righteous live by faith. Hebrews 3:12 is the next one. So this also deals with the Exodus generation as well here. But it also deals with the fact that believers fall into this. Take care, brothers. In other words, be on guard. Be alert for the fact that this can happen. That there not be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God. So people say, you know, of course, you know, this, the whole idea of the perseverance of the saints, which takes various forms in various religions, that all believers are just going to make it to the end and they'll all be hitting on all cylinders and they'll always come back. That's not true. If this warning weren't possible, then it wouldn't be here. But the warning suggests that this is very possible. That one, and he calls the unbelief, the heart of unbelief, he calls it evil. In falling away, that falls away from the living God. Verse 19, so we see that they were not able to enter because of unbelief. That's the Exodus generation. They didn't ever get into the promised land. Even though God had it for them, was going to give it to them, he killed them all off over 40 years and left them out there in the desert, in the wilderness, wandering around for 40 years until they were all dead. And then their children got to go in and inherit what God had promised them. But their children exercised faith. They didn't. And God ultimately ended up killing that whole generation, many of them believers. But they were believers that would not go on with the truth. Hebrews 4:2, for indeed we have had good news preached to us, just as they did also. But the word they heard did not profit them, because it was not united by faith in those who heard. And so if the word of God you hear in Bible class isn't, if you don't exercise faith toward it, it doesn't do you any good. I could be the greatest teacher that ever lived. It wouldn't make any difference. It could be Jesus Christ himself standing up here talking. But if the word of God is not united in the heart with faith, if you don't believe it, it becomes worthless to you. In fact, it becomes a stumbling block to you, ultimately. So 15, while there is certainly a difference between healing and casting out demons and supplying food for a massive crowd, it is not that one really requires more power than another. And 16, after all, it takes supernatural power to heal the sick and exorcise demons. Therefore, the apostles could have simply recognized that the same supernatural power they had used for the benefit of others could also be used here. And 17, while it was certainly a leap of faith, it was one that they could have made, and one they certainly needed to make. So again, we try to be even-handed with the disciples, particularly the apostles, when we're dealing with them, because they face such limitations. But on the other hand, they need their butts kicked sometimes. I mean, they're really fouling up on certain occasions because they aren't applying faith to their situation. They're running under unbelief. And they've got, as we're going to find out later, their heart was hardened. And as we know, the hard heart is the potential for those who do not walk in faith. Your heart gets hard. So again, we're not saying it did require a leap of faith. It did. But could they have made it? And the answer is yes. And Jesus expected them to. And he's going to use this situation here and another later situation when he feeds another massive crowd to point out to them that they didn't get it. That you guys are not getting it. What aren't they getting? They aren't getting that Jesus is God. That in Jesus stands God incarnate before them. They're not getting that. So 18, it should be pointed out that this is the only miracle that is recorded in all four of the Gospels, attesting to its vital nature in the ministry of Jesus Christ and its actual impact on the apostles. And 19, in fact, this miracle sets the stage for the extended doctrinal teaching in John 6, which prompted many to reject Jesus at that time. Now, the teaching of John 6 doesn't occur until the next day. But this miracle occurs pretty late in the day, and the teaching of John 6 probably begins at least that next morning sometime. We don't know specifically when. But it would have taken, and it could have been even later in the day, it could have been in the afternoon, because what we're going to find is that many who were present for this feeding make the trip back across the Sea of Galilee and end up back in the region of Gennesaret, or Capernaum, and there Jesus is going to address them. John 6:60, therefore many of his disciples heard, when they heard this, said, this is a difficult statement. Who can listen to it? And verse 66, and as a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. So they make their statement. Guess what? Here's what I've learned about the doctrine of separation. If you're a positive believer and you really want to do it right, people will apply it for you. They will apply it for you. And very seldom have I ever had to apply it. Most people separate from me once they go negative. They don't want anything to do with me after that. I've become persona non grata. I am on their bad list. I went from the nice list to the naughty list. Why? Because they went negative. Not because I changed. I'm still doing the same thing I was doing 20 years ago. But the reality, and hopefully doing it better. But the reality is, most of the time, it's been my experience that the positive believer that wants to do it right, you don't have to spend much time worrying about separation. The negative will separate from you just fine. And I say, good riddance. You know, let them go. It doesn't bother me. And it clearly didn't bother Jesus. Because Jesus turns around and looks at the 12. You guys want to go too? Hit it. Hit the road. Go. I don't care. Because he didn't care at that level. And see, this really troubles people. Well, how could Jesus be so callous? I mean, my word. But he's pointing out to them, if you're not going to embrace what I'm teaching, you might just as well leave. You are wasting your time and mine if you're not going to embrace the teaching. And the teaching on this day was difficult. Granted, it was admittedly difficult. But you either have to have faith that Jesus knows what he's doing or you don't. And most people did not. Ultimately, at the end, they just kind of, many of them wrote him off. Some thought he was demon-possessed. Some just thought he was a man that had kind of lost his mind. Nobody thought he was God, as far as I know, other than John the Baptist, and he's dead by now. And so, therefore, Jesus, he just looks at him and says, hey, I don't care. And they don't like, and some people don't like, again, the fact that this seems kind of callous. But in the end, that's all you can really do. If people will not adhere to the teaching, you can't do anything for them. No matter how much you love them, no matter how much you care, you just have to say, well, you've got to get with the truth. It's doctrine that's going to help you, not me. So don't go out there and be people's crutches because they need crutches. Guess what? The entire society is crippled. Literally. And if you're going to be a crutch for one, you're going to end up being a crutch for all of them. And at a certain point, we tell people, you got to stand on your own spiritual 2 feet. In the end, you've got to. I can't make it for you. I can't nurse you along. I mean, I can do what I can, but ultimately it's going to be on you. Well, 20 John's is the only account that provides us some critical information, which provides insight into Jesus and the manner he operated on this occasion. John 6, 5 through 7. And this is only recorded in John. Therefore, Jesus, lifting up his eyes and seeing that a large crowd was coming to him, said to Philip, where are we to buy bread so that these may eat? And this he was saying to test him. Oh, so Jesus tests us, huh? Yeah, he throws curveballs at us to see if we can hit them. By the way, if you can't hit the curveball, you'll never play in the majors. So, and you're never going to grow up spiritually if you don't learn how to handle spiritual curveballs in some sense. Because you never know what each day is going to hold. And Philip answered him. So Philip's like, oh, well, let's see. 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for every one of them, for everyone to receive a little. And that wouldn't have been enough to get them full. He said, even if we spent 7 months' pay on this, people are just going to get a scrap. That's all they're going to get. So that seems like a stupid waste of time. And see, and so here is where I think the disciples key off of the 200 denarii figure. Philip probably said it first. And then they take up the chant. 200 denarii is not enough. and let Jesus know, hey, this is not possible. Well, he's going to show them anything is possible. You just don't believe yet. But you're going to find out. And they don't still get it. Even and here's what you get. So people say, oh, if I could just see miracles, if I just saw some sign that God was with him. No, people saw all kinds of signs. Didn't change them. Well, A, in that account, Jesus Christ calls Philip aside and asks him a question that is designed to get Philip to consider the situation they face. And maybe, and who knows, I mean, it seems to me Philip is pretty much of a pragmatist here. I mean, he's kind of calculating in his head. He's, crunching the numbers. What do we do? Well, B, some have suggested that Jesus asked Philip this question because Philip was in charge of the food. C, more likely it was designed to make Philip recognize the impossibility of the situation and to encourage him to think in terms of faith. And D, it is evident that the disciples were weak in faith to some extent. But Philip manifests a good deal of confusion even at the end of Jesus' ministry. And Philip, in this case, he expresses what they all kind of end up saying. And then here, Philip, in John 14, and this is on the last night of Jesus' life, and in John 14, Philip sort of articulates what the rest of the disciples think again. He gives voice to the confusion that they actually feel. John 14:8, but Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough for us. And Jesus just said, if you had known me, you would have known my Father also. And from now on, you know him and have seen him. Well, wait a minute, is Jesus saying he's God? Yes. And Philip says, Lord, show us the Father, and it's enough. What do you do with that? You know, Jesus probably had to just go, did I not make myself clear? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. What? You're God? Nah. And he still wouldn't get it. Even when Jesus spells this out to them point blank, they don't get it. And Jesus says, have I been with you so long with you, and yet you have not come to know me, Philip? He who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? You don't know that I'm God the Son. You know, you haven't figured it out till yet. Well, I think, and Philip, I don't want to be any harder on him than the rest of the disciples because I think he manifests exactly what they all thought. Now, this was the same unbelief they all faced. It is difficult to say exactly when Jesus Christ asked Philip this question, but it seems likely that it was addressed to him after the disciples' suggestion to get rid of the crowds. And F, verse 6 is parenthetical, giving us insight into the thinking of Jesus in this situation. There where he said, now this he was saying to test him. That's just John's explanation of Jesus' motivation. His question was designed to test Philip. It was not because Jesus Christ did not know or because he did not know what his own intentions were. He knows where Philip's at and he's thinking, and he knows. And Philip very much, to my thinking, just articulates the current views of the disciples. When you see these guys talk, I don't think that it's any value to be any harder on Philip or Peter or any of the others when they talk, because the reality is that these men kind of expressed verbally what they all were going through, I think. Although Jesus was aware of what he had planned, it is evident that Philip, who likely represents the thinking of the entire group, had his eyes on the temporal resources that he knew were not sufficient. So Philip, at least what he does, is he sizes the situation up from the material point of view. and at least stops and kind of thinks through it. And comes to the conclusion, well, Jesus, nothing can be done. Well, guess what? He's wrong. That's just his thinking. And he's wrong. And J, again, what is attributed only to Philip in John's account likely represents the thinking and views of those with him. So 21, Mark's account suggests that the group responded as a whole, with their response coming in the form of an incredulous question. Mark expresses it as a question, shall we go and spend 200 denarii? And again, I think you had to be there to hear the sarcasm in their tone. And this is where, obviously, when you're studying the written word, it's very difficult to read tone and facial expression. But given the way that they've talked to Jesus before, and given the fact that they are walking in unbelief at this point, it's not hard to believe that they didn't give Jesus a little bit of their express, sort of their frustration with him. You know, you're saying dumb stuff, Jesus. I mean, we can't do this. Get real. It was sort of their deal. And 22, there is little doubt that their question was expressed with an element of exasperation, which was something they certainly manifested with Jesus from time to time. We saw that and that's the one where the woman who's got the issue of blood touches him. And Jesus goes, who touched me? Freaking crowd here, you don't know. How do we know who touched you? I mean, that's the way they felt. And they expressed it to him. So the same thing I think is going on here. They're frustrated, they're tired, but again, they're not walking in faith at this point. So 23, the force of their question is that even if they had the money, which they did not, and there were adequate provisions in the region, which there were not, why would they spend such a large amount of money to provide for people that they did not really even know? I mean, they may have known some in the crowd, but surely they didn't know them all. I mean, if you're talking a group this large, they didn't know all the disciples, the 12. So 24, both Mark and John mention the figure of 200 denarii, which would likely have been far more than the group ever kept in their relatively small treasury. It wouldn't seem likely to me that Jesus would have 7 months' provision laid aside, particularly in light of his teachings that, you know, God's got to provide, you got to live each day as it comes, and God's got to provide your living grace for that day. Give us this day our daily bread. No, I'm laying up 7 months in advance. That doesn't fit to me with the tenor of Jesus' teaching or the way he would have lived, I don't think. I don't think Jesus died with a massive savings account. I don't think he had any savings account. Now, this is not teaching against saving money, by the way, because there's mucho in the Bible about saving money. But Jesus' niche is obviously unique. I mean, he knows he's going to be crucified as a criminal and all that, and going to rise the third day. So in some ways, money means very little to him. But obviously, they've got needs, and he's got to take care of his little band of merry men there. And so he has to provide for them in some ways. But I don't see them as having a seven-month supply in their treasury. That to me, would seem incredibly large, given the nature of his teaching and the nature of his ministry. Well, 25, the denarius was a silver coin which weighed around 4.5 grams. It came to be devalued under the reign of Nero in 54 to 68, and it was commonly recognized as the average daily wage of the common laborer. So even when we talk about an average daily wage, we're not even talking about the average, say, across the country as a whole. We're talking about these were the day laborers. This is what they would have made, which I suspect would have been enough to sustain a person for a day. That's what it was meant to do. I would presume that a denarius would buy about 3 meals, roughly. Maybe you could stretch it a little further. But 26, therefore, even this amount of money would have been in excess of 6 months' pay. And additionally, Philip points out that even this amount would only provide a few morsels to each of those assembled. I mean, okay, each one of you here is going to get a quarter of a saltine cracker. I mean, that would have been what we're talking about. Now, you take that cracker and you divide it 4 ways. How big is that? It's about the size of what you take on the Lord's table. See, we scrimp. We use the smallest cracker possible. No, we don't. I'm just kidding. But the point is, you don't get much. And that's exactly what we're talking about. That's the type of amount of food they would have gotten. If it would have stretched that far, even. So this is, there's no way this works. And they're, and the people are not, again, hungry. They're probably starving by now. This is later in the day. They haven't eaten since breakfast, most likely. Well, it would seem, 27, it would seem that the other apostles key off the figure Philip mentions and ask their question based on that number. And 28, these men have made the critical error of focusing on their own abilities and resources. They have not yet factored in the omnipotence of the Son of God. Now, what do I have and what can I do? Well, if I look at my situation from the human perspective, I'm limited to what my resources are. But if I look at it from God's perspective, there is no limitation because there is no lack of resources. And so God is free to bless or not bless the people as he chooses to. And one of the things I think that becomes very evident is that how people get blessed is very much commensurate with how they give. That one of the things we learn in the Christian life, obviously, as Paul taught to the Corinthians, was that as you give, God multiplies your provision. And so this is why, you know, once a week, we only do it weekly. I mean, other people can do it other times. We're not against it or anything, but I mean, we just offer once a week for you to engage in the principle of grace giving. And so why? Because this sets you up for potential financial blessing. Now, we're not to that's not to be our motivation for giving, but for me to not tell you that the scriptures are pretty clear that the one who waters will himself be watered. Cast your bread on the waters and it will return to you in many days. Divide your portion to seven or eight. And then you got the factor of the muzzling the ox deal. And you got all kinds of motivations for giving, supporting God's plan. You return a part of your living grace back to God. And God honors that because you're doing that in faith. And not, again, the idea, well, I want to give so God will give me more. Well, if that's only a motivation, God may not honor that. Now, he may, I don't know. I can't say exactly what all God would do. But I understand we should have other motivations than that. Well, here, some people get blessed. Why? Because they're generous, frankly. Some people don't get blessed because they're tightwads. I mean, that's just the reality of it. So one of the things you learn in the Christian life is, you know, try not to be a tightwad. Try to be generous. Because, you know, if you want God to bless you, well, bless others. And beginning, obviously, with grace giving, we believe that is to be the foundation, fundamental starting point, you know, the support of the plan of God in terms of doctrine. But then there's other ways and times to giving as is appropriate. So, but if you just focus on what you have in your own resources and you don't factor in God, well, you're limited. You're very limited to what you can do. And 29, in a similar fashion, some believers are too focused on their own abilities to confront and handle the various situations in life, never recognizing that the power of God is there to provide for them and support them. And 30, when the believer is confronted with royal imperatives that may be difficult to execute, he should not immediately panic and presume that it can't be done. And that's what, again, that's where some people get to in their thinking, oh, this is hard, I can't do it. Well, Paul says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So which line are you going to live on? Paul's line, Paul's thinking, or are you going to live on your own? I can't. And each person's going to have to confront this at various times in life. And it'd be nice if you just got like one test and then you got past it and that was fine, that was it. It's going to be on multitudes of fronts. You'll be tested with living grace. You'll be tested with friendship. You'll be tested under separation. You'll be tested under authority. You'll be tested on your job. You'll be tested in your personal relationships. You may be tested in your marriage. You will be tested if you're married. Nobody gets scot-free in that one. You're going to be tested if you're married. If you have kids, you're going to be tested. If you have parents, you're going to be tested. If you have a job, you're going to be tested. You're picking up testing. Lots of it. On all fronts. Your money will be tested. Your patience will be tested. You know, all these things. So people just, oh, I can't do it. Well, that's just manifest unbelief. Well, 31, as with the disciples in this situation, believers have to learn to focus on the unseen eternal realm and not limit God to their temporal circumstances. 2 Corinthians 5:7. So God doesn't have any limitations. So why do we see a limitation in the manifestation of God's provisions? Lots of reasons. But the biggest one is unbelief. Some people just quit believing the doctrine. Various things happen in their niche, and they just stop believing the truth. They opt for some human viewpoint, or even worse, doctrine of demon, to deal with the situations. 2 Corinthians 5:7, "For we walk by faith, and not by sight. And the one who pleases God," guess what? He has to walk by faith. I've never seen Jesus. I've never seen one miracle. I've never seen an angel. I've never seen a demon that I know of. All these that I know of. I've never seen one increment of SG3. I've never seen one bit of eternal reward. I've never seen a part of a resurrection body, let alone a whole one. I've never lived one moment without a sin nature. And yet, I have faith that all these things are not only real, but that they will happen. So, again, while people can, because of their stupidity, they bring the rapture into question and various things like that, doesn't bother me. My faith is still that God will return at the proper time. And he will take believers off of this planet prior to Daniel's 70th week. And the only people that will really appreciate it are the ones in the know. It's going to happen to all believers in the church age that are alive anyway at that time. And that have died too, for that matter. But how many of them will have appreciation for it? Well, the Philadelphia church is the only one that it's promised to. Now, it happens to the other people. But they have the promise, the rapture, okay. And then it's spelled out for us, say, in 1 Thessalonians there. So 32, it should be evident that the disciples could have asked Jesus more questions or requested specific direction as to what they should do. However, they simply did what they often did when they lacked understanding and questioned his judgment. So that's immediately the tack to take. If your spiritual leader gives you some command and you don't understand it, immediately assume he's nuts and that it can't be done. And then give him a list of reasons why it can't be done. And guess what? Hopefully, like Jesus, he'll turn and, handle it. Well, 33, as has been noted by many, the fact that Jesus Christ will feed all that assembled is a manifestation of what is referred to theologically as common grace. And 34, common grace refers to the things that God provides for all people, irrespective of any factor other than the goodness of God. The only factor in this is God's goodness. And he talks about this. 35, he provides many things like the sun, rain, food, and a host of other blessings to people that are not oriented to God or his plan. Matthew 5:45, and we see this not, again, because of anything people possess, but simply because of the goodness of God. And so he provides for our enemies. Curses. Well, no, we got to recognize, and this is why he deals with this in this context. I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those that persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. In other words, so you can be like him. So you can manifest God-likeness. This is how God is. God does good things for people, even evil people. For he causes his son to rise on the evil and the good. And by the way, it's his son. I mean, he could do with it what he wants. I mean, theoretically, God has the power to only give light to people who are believers. And yet he doesn't. I mean, literally, if you were an unbeliever, God could fix this universe to in such a way that you walked around in darkness at all time. Even during the brightest day of sunlight, like we have out there today. God has the power to do all these things, but he chooses to show how good he is. He causes his son to rise on the evil and the good. And he sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. And so God provides all kinds of things. People get all kinds of blessings in life, certain things, only because God is good. And for no other reason. Not because of them. Not because of any reason he needs to do it for them. He just provides. And 36, God does not withhold certain basic blessings, like falling in love, having a new baby, and many other temporal blessings and pleasures, from those that hate him and reject him. You can go out there tonight to the beach, any beach, on the west coast of Florida. You'll probably find a drum circle and some weirdos and a bunch of people watching the sunset. And they'll ooh and aah over the sunset, especially if you get a little cloud cover where they're really pretty. And guess what? They can be absolute enemies of God, hate God, and he still gives them that beautiful sunset every night. And he doesn't just, God could fix it, I suppose, if he wanted to where they'd never see that, never have any appreciation for it, and never any temporal capacity. But God does this. He provides stuff for people. People get jobs, people make money, people have all kinds of blessings. Get married. Even two negative unbelievers who hate God can get married and experience a certain amount of temporal happiness because of the divine institution. Because God instituted this. Everybody on planet Earth gets to exercise free will at all times, and that's nothing more than the goodness of God. That's total freedom. And yet they don't, unfortunately, many of them are in bondage. The irony that their will is free, and yet they're in bondage to the powers of evil because they don't know any better. Or they don't want to know any better, even worse. So rather here, he provides things freely as a part of his gracious plan and benevolent nature. God is good, God is nice, God gives to people. So what do we know, what have we learned about God today, boys and girls? Well, we've learned he's nice. He's nice to people. He's nice to his enemies even. Now, obviously, one of the things you better learn is that God's grace has an end to it. That there comes a point where grace runs out. Now, that's not what we're talking about here, but just to put this in balance, you have to know that as well. And the unbeliever will find out when he dies that God's grace is over for him. He's going to spend eternity in the lake of fire. That he'll find out when he's dead, but it's too late then to do anything about it. So 37, as he has done in many cases, Jesus does not interview the masses, ask them their theological views, examine their mental attitudes, or any other thing. Rather, he provides indiscriminately for all those who are assembled. And this is another example that, although he began to require more in the way of faith, this whole thing didn't have anything to do with the faith of anybody. He was going to provide food that day for everybody, no matter what. Everybody was going to get fed that day. And I don't mean just get fed. I mean they were going to have a meal that they enjoyed, and they were going to be full, and there was going to be scraps left over afterwards. In fact, as we're going to find out, we won't get to it today, of course, but if you look ahead in the text, in verse 42, they all ate and were satisfied, satiated, full. They weren't hungry anymore. Everybody got enough food that they weren't hungry. That's one of the worst things ever. Never invite a person over to your house and not have enough food to feed them. That is just dumb. And Jesus doesn't do that. This is one of the things we see here. He doesn't do that. I remember many years ago, it was many, many years ago, when I first got into the ministry as a Baptist, I was a fundy. And this guy invited us over to his house, and we kind of sat down and ate. And at the end of it, we were still really hungry because they didn't have very much food. Now, maybe that was all they had. I don't know. Maybe they didn't know how to show hospitality. I don't know. But we stopped at Taco Bell on the way home. So, or whatever it was, Taco Tico or whatever it was there, some other place. And that always stood out to me. And that was a real lesson. I thought, never do that. That is not cool. And Jesus doesn't do that. So they're all satisfied. And they picked up 12 full baskets of the broken pieces and also of the fish. And guess what? Jesus didn't take orders. You send the apostles around. Okay, find out what everybody wants to eat. They all got bread and fish, which was the staple diet of that time anyway. It wasn't as though it was weird or anything. It was what typically they would have eaten anyway. And so and you can sit out there in the crowd, well, I don't like fish. Fine, don't eat. Stay hungry. Jesus didn't care. But see, nobody seemed to say that day. It was weird. Nobody seemed to say they didn't like fish. They were hungry. And by the way, if you're hungry enough, I watch these survival shows, you'll eat anything. I mean, beetles, rats, larvae, grub worms. I mean, I've seen them eat some. So this you get right before lunch. This is probably stirring up your appetite, isn't it? Okay, well, we will stop there. Our time is gone, so we will pick up here with the next verse on a Tuesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of coming together and studying your plan. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.